It was a case of auld lang syne.
Auld lang syne.
You know.
Yes, I'm an expert at it. Especially tonight. And what did you drink for?
You're supposed to be at the Calvin Tavern at good time.
Is that the reason why?
No, who wants to go there, for God's sake?
Well, I came back as soon as I could to pick you up at Sophie. When I got there, you were coming out the door with us. With him. And you were giggling like a pony.
Well, I was plastered. I said so. You want a written confession?
You don't get plastered and flushes down the drain for no reason. And Taubman's party, isn't it? Now, I want the reason why. I want the truth. Why? You're supposed to get up there, won't
you? Oh.
Let's go back and play with you.
Okay.
I'll take you back, please. You don't get plastered and flushes down the drain for no reason at all. I want the reason. And Calvin's party is Calvin's party, isn't it? Now, I want the reason.
Oh.
Don't walk away from me when I'm talking to you. Because when something happens to me, I can't know the reason.
Beginning to make. bridge to cross, to come into contact with the absolute of this new life about to breathe again. We contact with this new life. There is hardly a limit to consider. The television camera alone feels obliged to let you see something, and the microphone let you hear a sound. Its purpose tonight is to take away a veneer, to look inside at the beginnings or the birth of this reality. The varied elements of this creation will be integrated in one final expression of many creative thoughts.
Continental United States, midway between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, the state of Nebraska rolls westward from the banks of the wide Missouri to the foothills of the Imperial Rockies. The name Nebraska, which in 1844 was first officially proposed to designate this region, is the white man's approximation of an Indian word meaning water flowing through a plain. What Nebraska means today, the image projected beyond its borders to the world at large, has been measurably influenced by the writings of three individuals, a novelist, a poet, and a historian. Nebraska, to many people, is first and foremost the state of Willa Cather, John G. Neihardt, and Mari Sandoz. Here to honor these writers who shaped the image of Nebraska, the land which shaped them, are two native Nebraskans, Professors Bernice Sloat and Robert Knoll. With them as their first guest is Nebraska's historian, Professor James C. Olson.
In 1963, we had the 50th anniversary of the publication of Willa Cather's O Pioneers, a book which gave a picture of Nebraska no outsider had ever dreamed existed. A picture not only of the pioneers subduing the wild land, but of a pioneer culture that was truly created.
The same year that Willa Cather was writing O Pioneers, John Neihardt was at work on the first of the five songs which comprise his Cycle of the West. Songs which tell the story, or rather celebrate the story of the courage and heroism of the people who built the West and of the Indians they vanquished.
And although Marie Sandoz, who was to become one of the historians of the region, was still too young to be writing, she was already thinking about her region. And her first stories were published in the Prairie Schooner in 1927, which John Neihardt served as an advisory editor. He saw 15 years of his life. Determines his viewpoint and his attitude toward the world he lives in. Do you think this is true?
Oh, I'm sure that must be true. Yes, I'm sure that you never get over your early experiences, you know, not fully. I love to be in mountains. I know they're beautiful and grand, but I feel happier when I get out in a vast country, you know, where the skyline's a long way off. Yes, I love it. I've been feeling that here since I came.
Did your wife know you thought this way?
Oh, yes. We used to drive around over the West, you know. I remember one day she told me, she said, Daddy, she said, I don't know anything about Western geography, but I always know when we're arriving because you begin to whistle.
What are your first memories, Mr. Neihardt?
Well, I lived in a sod house in northwestern Kansas 75 years ago with my grandfather and grandmother out on the Solomon River in northwestern Kansas. That was the beginning.
In a sod house?
Yes.
Were there any trees there at all?
Those that my grandfather planted, and they were only little whips when I saw them. I saw him planting them. Yes, I've seen them since. Big trees.
I take it that then you didn't have any firewood.
Oh, no, we burned cow chips.
Cow chips?
Cow chips, yes. We were living in antiquity, you know. Dirt floor, no one was... There was no poverty, but nobody had any money. And everyone was self-respecting, and everybody respected everybody else. And they had a happy time. And we had only cow chips for fuel, and lived in a sod house. And for light, we had a wick in lard in a bowl, and that's all we had for light, you know, because people went to bed with chickens.
Well, there were fires.
Oh, yes, prairie fires, you mean? Terrific prairie. Now he strove to rise, the wide, blind stare of anguish in his eyes, and someone shouted, "Kill the devil, quick!" A throaty murmur and a running click of gun locks woke among the crowding Sioux, and many a soldier whitened. Well, they knew what pent-up hate the moment might release to drop upon the bungled farce of peace a bloody curtain. One began to talk as commandant of the fort. His tongue was drunken and his face was chalk. But when a half-breed shouted what he spoke, the crowd believed. So few had seen the stroke, nor was there any bleeding of the wound. This is what they told the Indians. It seemed the chief had fallen sick and swooned. Perhaps a little rest would make him strong. And silently they watched him borne along, a sagging bundle, dear and mighty yet, though from the sharp face, beaded with the sweat of agony, already peered the ghost. They laid him in an office of the post, and soldiers, forming in a hollow square, held back the people. Silence deepened there. A little while it seemed the man was dead. He lay so still. The west no longer bled. Among the crowd the dust began to creep. Then suddenly, as startled out of sleep by some old dream-remembered night alarm, he strode to shout, half rose upon an arm, and glared about him in the lamplit place. The flare across the ashes of his face went out. He spoke, and leaning where he lay, men strained to gather what he strove to say, so hard the panting labor of his words. Many thought he was singing his death song, because if the pain made his speaking lyrical. Men strained together what he strove to say, so hard the panting labor of his words. I had my village and my pony herds on Powder, where the land is all my own. I only wanted to be let alone. I did not want to fight. The gray fox sent his soldiers. We were poorer when they went. Our babies died from many lodges burned, and it was cold. We hoped again and turned our faces westward. It was just the same out yonder in the Rosebud. Gray Fox came. The dust his soldiers made was high and long. I fought him and I whipped him. Was it wrong to drive him back? That country was my own. I only wanted to be let alone. I did not want to see my people die. They say I murdered Long Hair. That's Custer. They say I murdered Long Hair. Why? His people came to kill us, and they died. I coughed and shivered, staring hungry-eyed as though to make the most of little light. And then, like a child that feels the coughing wind, and I cries the wilder, deeming it in vain, raise the voice made when I fall pain and power of the thing about to be. I want to see you, Father, come to me. I want to see you, Mother. Oh, no, his cry assailed the darkness of the door, and from the gloom beyond the hollow square of soldiers quavered voices of despair. We cannot come, they will not let us come. And when at length the lyric voice was dumb, and Crazy Horse was nothing but a name.
Mari Sandoz also has a knowledge of Crazy Horse and has written about him. She has a famous detailed knowledge of the region in which Crazy Horse died, which is northwestern Nebraska.
Well, talking of the past, I like to think that the beginning was this little girl who sat on the gatepost, and she'd rather read than eat. Isn't this how your writing all began?
Oh, yes. I'd rather read than eat. I'd rather read than eat now. But that gatepost was a nice big old heavy one, broad on top and flat, and people went by. The world went by. Cowboys, Indians, and the wind and the birds, and the dishes were behind me in the house.
You worked hard, didn't you, when you were a child?
Oh, every pioneer child works hard because the mother always has a lot to do, and the dishes and the children, making the beds and peeling the potatoes and gathering the peas for dinner. That's part of the work.
And you used to do something with your father's trap lines too, didn't you? And
yes, I ran the trap line every once in a while. In fact, I caught a beautiful mink one time, and on the way, I didn't want to hit it very hard because I didn't want to spoil the fur. And on the way home, I turned my cattle on my shoulder and came around and said, "Oh, look, I'm
tired." It's a funny thing, this compulsion you had for books, wasn't it? Because you weren't allowed to write or read, were you, in a literary sense?
Well, the Sandals were not supposed to read fiction. That was for the hired girl and hired man. The fact that we had neither hired girl or hired man made no difference. You still didn't read fiction. But, an obstacle scripture child.
Yes, I know. You had to hide all these books and read by candlelight. But the happiest time that I've just been reading about you all week, and the happiest time seems to me the time you were in Lincoln when you didn't have any money. You called it your Greenwich Village time. It was a nice time because I had just enough to pay that $8 a month. And if I got too far behind, the landlady would sort of overlook it for a month or two. And there were an awful lot of other creative young people around. And music and several poets and short story writers. And
We did all the usual things. We carried the American Mercury around under our arms, you know, and all that kind of thing. And we sneaked Ulysses and read Ulysses and things like that kind.
And you finally gave up your job, didn't you, and decided you just had to write.
Well, every time I'd get $50 in the bank, I'd quit any job I had, you see, and write a while. Because I was always under the impression that while I used up that $50, if I nursed it a couple of months, I would certainly sell a short story. But I didn't know.
Yeah. Those must have been good days. There's Dr. Wimberly and Lauren Isley,
yeah,
and
that's right, yeah. Mabel Lane and Lauren's wife, and Lauren back on the Fox, and of course, Dorothy Thomas, and Tuck Stanley, Edward Stanley, who writes Revolutionary War stories and runs the newspaper in the East, and his wife, Pauline Gund from the Western part of the state. And a whole lot of people were working here, writing at the time. Lasalle Gilman, and then we had all kinds of, some of the most interesting ones never got anything published. What we call the suppression of ideas in America. And if we'd had money, we might have gone to Paris, but I don't think we had. I was too close to the European scene, you see, my folks both being Swiss immigrants. I don't think the immigrant child feels the need to go to Europe so much as the one who has a connection with Europeans. I didn't feel that Europe was any place to flee to, but we certainly felt, you see, that ideas were being stifled.
Yes, you know, this is the same talk of young people today,
Yes.
Talk about the time when you were working in the Historical Society and got the telephone.
Well, this is the 14th time out, so the second time to the Atlantic.
What is it?
And this long telegram came. I had, a young man...
I can't come right now.
Work tomorrow. And I had to solve his problems. And this long telegram came and I looked at it, a bit long thing, and I just sort of turned it off. I had changed it to something else because they detected it, so now it's all yours. Well, anyway, I read this long thing, and I'm pretty sure that's what it meant, that I am going to surprise. The head of the society, and he looked at it, and he shaped up very white. So then I knew what it was. He said, "This is where we lose you." Do you remember starting to having to write this book, old Jewel? I always wanted to write it because I decided when I was 21 that I would do a 6-book study of modern man's incumbency, that is modern man's sociological, because you know, just as modern physiological. Modern man sociologically on the Stone Age Jesus, the great claim, and what and his incumbency coming into Stone Age Jesus in a good time, modern time, conquering the great claims, what he would do to the region, and what it would do to him, you see. Because you cannot conquer anything without getting absorbing something into conquering.
How true.
Yeah. And so I was interested in what this would be, and I knew when I was 21 it would take 6 books at least. I had all time.
There's a unity in this Sandoz work, and I think the source of that unity is the emotional identification which she establishes with her subject, with the area, and with the people.
The idea that we get of Nebraska from her work is a good deal like the idea we get of Nebraska from John G. Neihardt's work, I think. That is, we find in both of them a great admiration for sentimental and unsentimental and courageous people who live in a nature which is essentially hostile to them, and who come through.
Yes.
Now, Miss Sandoz has said, you know, of the pioneers, she said one time, there was, of course, no training school for the pioneer. He went out and was one, or wasn't.
That's the story of pioneering.
Yes, you cross the river and you fall in.
Though she's unsentimental, and though Neihardt's unsentimental about the pioneers, very sentimental about the Indians. For example, this book of Crazy Horse is Crazy Horse's story. And she even has, in the back of the book, you know, a white man's chronology of the events as an appendix. Mm-hmm. She, again, this emotional involvement with people here.
But in the emotional involvement, there is a sense that out of this one plot of earth will come the world. She said once, I should like to understand as much as possible about man, shaped by and shaping his world. And through the discovery of this one region, this one piece of water, I hope to discover something of the nature of the ocean.
That's pretty good, you know, to see a microcosm in the land you live in. This is a kind of wisdom, to recognize that what you yourself have is the key to everything.
It's a universal thing. And that in the earth, there is the cosmos.
I must say that we're much richer for having these people.
Oh, yes, indeed.
We would be much impoverished without these letters to show us the eternal verities in the land we live in.
And in this picture of Nebraska, through Molly Sandoz, she tells something like this. I'd like to climb to the top of Indian Hill.
The Texaco Dieter may not look bigger than other Dieter.
Shimmering mirages. The gravel under my bare feet was black from Indian signal fires. And just below me was the place where our father had led a vigilante gang that hanged a man and let him down alive. I didn't see the hanging, but I had seen births and dying long before either was a shock. And the hardship, the violence, and gaiety of homestead life. And this violence and gaiety of homestead life is perhaps best known in the songs of the region, as we hear them sung by Robert Menlo.
I am looking rather seedy now while living on my claim, and my victuals are not always served the best. And the mice play shyly round me as I settle down to rest in my little old sod shanty on my claim. Oh, the hinges are of leather, and the windows have no glass, and the board roof lets the howling blizzard in. But I'm happy as a clam here on the land of Uncle Sam, in my little old sod shanty on my claim. When I left my eastern home, a bachelor so gay, to try to win my way to wealth and fame, whoever thought I'd come down to burning twists of hay in my little old sod shanty on my claim. Oh, the hinges are of leather, and the windows have no glass, and the board roof lets the howling blizzard in. And I hear the hungry coyote as he sneaks up through the grass round my little old sod shanty on my claim. Tom Hyde is my name, an old bachelor I am. You'll find me out west in the land of fame. You'll find me out west on an elegant plain, starving to death on my government claim. So hurrah for Greer County, the land of the free, the land of the bedbug, grasshopper, and flea. I'll sing of its praises and tell of its fame, while starving to death on my government claim. So goodbye to Greer County, where blizzards arise, where the sun never sinks and the flea never dies, and the wind never ceases, but always remains, till it starves us all off of our government claim. You ask the place we like the best, the sand hills, oh, the old sand hills, the place Kincaiders call their home, and prairie chickens freely roam. In all Nebraska's wide domain, 'tis the place we long to see again. The sandhills are the very best. She is the queen of all the rest. Where makes the land of desert sweet, where nothing grows for man to eat. The wind that blows, the plains so hard to beat. Nebraska land, Nebraska land, as on my desert soil I stand and gaze away across the plain.
with the three authors, Will Cather, Mari Sandoz, and John Neihardt, whose writings have helped to shape the image of Nebraska, we have looked at the Nebraska of Neihardt and the Nebraska of Sandoz. And now as we turn into the world of Will Cather.
Namesake, of course, which really refers to my mother's brother, who was killed in the Confederate Army, fighting in the Confederate Army at the Second Battle of Manassas. Mother had only three brothers, and all three of them were in the Confederate Army.
And this is called the namesake. Was Willa Cather actually named?
She wasn't actually named for him. He was William, of course, and she was Willa, but she was not named for him. She was named for a little sister of my father's who had died as a child.
In a way, she pretended that she was named for him.
She just pretended.
And identified herself with him. Did everybody call her Willa?
Well, of course, nobody in the family called her Willa, and nobody in Red Cloud called her Willa. We always called her Willie. But as soon as she left Red Cloud and came down to Lincoln all the rest of her life, to the friends she made after she came to Lincoln, she was always Willa.
Well, then in the namesake, there was a feeling, you know, William and Willie probably very much alike.
Oh, yes, and we always referred to my Uncle William as Uncle Willie. I never heard Mother call him William. She called him Willie.
So they really both were Willie.
They were both Willie, yes.
Well, I'm sure that this is something in the family that meant a great deal to everyone, the thought of the uncle who died in the Civil War. And there is in the poem a feeling that reminds me of some things in her books, too, of young people dying and the feeling of loss. Did you feel anything of this in the things that she wrote in her poetry?
Well, yes, of course it's always easier for people when they're young to dwell on the idea of death as they get older, and the actual fact is closer.
That is true, and there is another poem, one of the home poems that deals with the death of a young man, The Night Express. Do you remember anything about it?
I remember it very well. It's always been one of my favorites. It describes so accurately and so clearly the approach to Red Cloud along the Republican River as the train comes in. I remember well the night that Willa wrote the poem of a young man who was one of the boys of the town had died somewhere away. I don't remember where. And we all sat out in the yard and
you heard the story then? That is, you heard the news?
Yes, we heard the news of the... We listened to the train as it actually came in, and we knew that the body was on it.
In the poem, the scene is at the station.
Oh, yes, but we were... Yes, I suppose some people did. We didn't. We were all there in the yard, and we heard the train pull in. We knew that the young friend was on the train being brought home. And Willa went upstairs then to her bedroom, and the rest of us stayed in the yard. I remember watching the light in her bedroom, and she just wrote the poem then and there.
Denise, when you were editing April Twilight, Willa...
About her knowledge of Willa Cather's career, and here is that interview as we were talking together.
Mrs. Sherwood, would you tell us about the first time you saw Willa Cather?
Well, the first time I saw her was in the store, and she was sitting on the base shelf back of the shoe counter having a pair of shoes fitted. And she was a very attractive child and apparently quite reserved and principally occupied with the answering her father's questions, which he was plying her with. As most parents, he was trying to show her off, I suppose. And I think maybe that I was as much attracted by her costume as I was by her face. She was dressed in those days, you know, they didn't have fabrics looking like fur like they do nowadays. But Willa had on a coat and a hat that looked like leopard skin. And of course that was very unusual in those days.
What year was this, Mrs. Sherwood? 1883?
About 83, I suppose.
And Willa would have been
83 or 4.
She would have been 9 or 10 years old
yes.
then.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What questions was her father asking her?
Oh, he was asking her questions about the history of the colonies in Virginia. And he was a great historian himself, and I think he had her pretty well posted. Very proud of her being able to answer his questions.
Well, then you watched her grow up in Red Cloud from that time on. Would you tell us what kind of little girl she was?
Well, of course, in a very short time, they moved into our neighborhood. And I found her quite reserved in a way, and also very free. She was like two people. She was one to me and another to the children. She associated with my sisters, who were one younger and one older than she, and they were playmates. But with me, she was a companion.
What did she want from you? What was her, aside from the companionship, what was she continually trying to find out from you?
Well, I don't know. She was always asking questions. She was constantly asking questions. When she used to walk with me to the store, and we'd stand outside of the door of the store and talk. And one day my father said, "What under the sun do you spend so much time with that child for? She's too curious." And so that was trouble. She
what
was always asking questions.
What did she want to know about? What sort of thing?
Oh, all about the people. You see, the store was always filled with foreign people, and she was always, if she saw them, then she wanted to know about them, and she'd have questions to ask about them.
Some of these people she used later on in her books. They came back to life in her writings.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, like Silas Garber.
Yeah.
The.
I never knew what she was asking questions for, but as long as she was interested, I always tried to answer her.
About that time, Annie Pavelka, or Annie Sedulak,
yeah.
came to your place. Tell us something about the sort of girl Annie was, because later on she became my Antonia.
Well, Annie was a very beautiful girl. She was about 16 years of age, and she had a wonderful complexion and beautiful hair, and a very stately position for a girl, for a young girl. And she was interested in everything and everybody, and she was unusually kind. She was just about my own age, and so we really enjoyed Annie, and I think she enjoyed us. And I was always interested in her because of the way she took hold of everything that Mama was trying to teach her in her American, our American way.
Of course, your mother was the Mrs. Harling in My Antonia. Do you think that Annie was pretty much the way Willa Cather described her in My Antonia? You think that's an adequate picture of her? An adequate one of
yes,
of your
very,
home life, too?
Yes, very, very. It was very true. She compared it to Mama. She thought that Annie was one who liked to feed children and see them in comfortable, warm beds. That was Annie.
In fact, your brother even had a favorite hickory cake that's mentioned in My Antonia, and I understand
yeah.
you still have the recipe in the family
yeah.
for that hickory cake that Annie used to make.
Well, the important part of that cake was picking out the nuts.
And I suppose the children did that in the kitchen.
Well, hickory nuts, you know, are not easy to, in the first place, they were hard to crack, and then after they were cracked, they were hard to pick out of the shell. Sometimes took Annie a week to pick enough her make a cupful for a cake.
We would think that was a very tiresome job now, wouldn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, we'd go to the store and buy them.
Tell us about Willa Cather's visits back to Red Cloud after she became famous. What did she want to do mainly? What things did she remember and want to repeat?
visiting over government orders, and going out in the country, the places that she had lived when she first came to town.
Look at those ears.
And meeting the people that she knew for so many years.
What was her favorite method of traveling on these trips, if it was possible?
Horse and buggy. She liked the horse and buggy days. And she just liked an automobile very much, and she didn't have very much confidence in one, and she had less confidence in the drivers, usually.
Willa Cather said several times, and she said it in one of the letters to you, that the things that impressed her the most happened to her when she was a girl, that her whole life was influenced by what happened up to the time she was 15. In reviewing her work in your mind, do you think that's true, that what happened there in Red Cloud were the important years to her?
Oh, certainly must have been, because it was her whole life.
And that's what she used thereafter.
Yes.
Did you ever ask her about how she felt about her life work, and did she give you any answer about how she felt about her work?
Oh, yes. Once when she was home, after she had written several books and done some very notable work, I said to her, "Were you satisfied, Willie, with choosing literature as your profession?" She said, "Oh, yes, Carrie." She walked up and down the floor. She said, "Oh, yes, yes." She says, "With Anthony, I feel that I have made a real contribution to American letters."
Prospecting and digging for gold. I'd tunneled hydraulic and cradled, and I have been frequently sold. I tried to get out of this country, but poverty forced me to stay. Until I became an old settler, now nothing can drive me away. Nothing can drive me away. Oh, nothing can drive me away. Until I became an old settler, now nothing can drive me away.
Critic Lawrence.
What is a bomb? Humane. Its intention is prevention. Hate to blow smoke in your dreams, but your wife is dead. Yes, dead, I said. Or so I gather from these talks we've had.
What did I say?
You said you were sad.
Why was I sad?
Your home was bombed and your wife was killed.
That's true. What about my parents?
Dead too.
And my kids.
I hate to blow smoke in your dreams, but you have no kids. No, you never did. Or so I gather from these talks we've had.
What did I say?
You said you were sad.
Why was I sad?
Your wife would not, so you had no kid.
I know, but still and all, did you have to go and blow so much smoke in my dreams?
Enough fooling around. Jacob Soldier and Philo's bombs!
Yes, Captain. Hello, Smiley.
Hello, Sergeant. Hello, Captain.
That is, hello, Captain. Hello, Sergeant. Have a prisoner?
No.
Next.
Those look like bombs, right, fellas? I know Baum's fellas, and those fellas look like nasty fellas, huh, fellas?
Cardia! What's that? Cardia!
Speak up! Speak up!
Distinctly!
Speak distinctly!
So that I can hear
Do you understand his language?
Are you fooling around? Are you playing?
Do you understand his language?
Are you kidding around? Are you praying?
Do you understand his language?
What a language for the birds!
Do you understand his language?
Not the word.
He doesn't know a word of our language. I know his. I'm an unofficial linguist of his language. Captain, what's the situation?
What situation?
The movie situation. We haven't had any major films during battle lull, and somebody promised. Listen, this prisoner is a prisoner with very important information. He knows all the best restaurants in town, which will be very important when we rule his homeland.
What do restaurants have to do with movies when we rule his homeland?
Well, what good is a good movie without a good restaurant when we rule his homeland? War is tough enough without eating in bad restaurants. Every time we rule a homeland, a certain Klimpatia. Here is the text in translation. She's in the army. His girl is in the army. She's the best lady soldier in the army right now. Says Klimpatia, how will we marry? How?
My lady, bad news. My wife's dead. My house bombed. My mother, my father, dead. Bombed. My dog raped. My sister's education interrupted. And I have no kids.
I know you told me.
I still have my church to go home to my hometown to. The church with the shiny dome I built around the corner from my non-existent home.
I hate to blow more smoke in your dreams, but your church was bombed.
My church was bombed. When we built the church, it was white and new. We sang, "Hello, God, belong to us. Look at the fuss we make over you." And the angels with shiny wings, flew over the cross and sing. When we built the steeple, it rose straight and true. We sang, "Hello, God, be good to us. Look at the fuss we make over you." And the airplanes with shiny wings flew over the cross and sing. Oh, they bombed the church, though they love you too. Hello, God, remember us, remember the fuss we made over you.
The bats. With their filthy wings. Hello, God! Hello, God! Hello, God! Are you tired too?
go out with a light heart and bomb people.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Sergeant.
Get out.
But your captaincy...
Out! Out! You're gonna be quite a people bomber.
Thank you, Captain.
One of the better people bombers.
Thank you, Captain.
The satirical purpose of dynamite. It's a trick. Kill him.
I can't.
Kill people when I tell you to kill people.
I can't.
Why not?
I have an infected trigger finger. I bite my nails. Oh, I know it's
regulations state always kill the enemy, no ifs, ands, or buts.
Piffalo. He had no gun.
You had no gun.
Piffalo. Seems unfair.
That's his rough luck.
That's his tough luck. Rough, tough, tragical luck.
Sympathia!
Mendo!
Kill him!
Mendo!
It's a girl! We'll kill her!
Mendo!
Sympathia!
Captain, you look human.
That's strange.
After a war, I always change. During the war, I'm tough and hard. During the war, I play it hard. Toughest and hardest of the boys playing the game that destroys. Tell them as far as we go, there's no hard feelings. We're at peace!
Yeah. Festus you.
Tell him I order him to be happy.
Festus yeah. You, temple!
Peace, G! Whoopee! Peace, wow! How? Interesting, peace, G! Whoopee! Peace, boy! What joy! Peace, G! See! Find a daddy, peace, great! Thanks, Saint! All peace, all peaceful! Peaceful, peaceful.
Ain't it great they lost?
I like it when they lost.
They lost?
They must have lost.
We won, which means they must have lost.
Who said they lost?
You said they lost.
You mean you think they said they lost?
I think I mean they said they lost.
I'm lost. Who won?
That's the one thing I don't know.
I forgot to ask who won the war.
Then I'll phone and ask who won the war.
Oh, no!
Don't phone and ask.
Why not phone and ask?
Because when we find out who won the war, we may be not the ones who won the war.
No news is good news.
We may be the ones who got what for.
No news is good news. No news is good news. It's good news is no news.
Miley, you're just not in it. Now, why didn't you dance? I ordered you to dance.
The reason I forgot to dance, I wasn't feeling well.
I hate to hurt your feelings, but you really look like hell. And by the by, tell me why. You're holding your eye.
Oh, this is where my eye used to be, lost in fighting.
I see you also lost a hand.
I lost it looking for my eye.
I understand. But you still have a good eye left. You won't miss one.
I'm blind in this one. Think of all the movies I won't be seeing just because I have no eye. Oh, I love the movies, movies, movies. I'll be very lost without them. Oh, I love the movies, movies, movies. I'll be very lost without them. Jumping snapshots, no more for me. Give me liberty, or give me republic pictures. I'll be very lost without them.
Your mistresses and wife. Also, you can lead a decent normal life or two.
Ah, oh, Captain, you're a wonderful guy. I'd like to give you a hand. On the other hand, I have no hand.
Pete! Wow!
What do we do now?
I've lost my hand, I've lost my sight. For the rest of my days, I'll only see night. Now what do I do?
I've lost my wife, my mom and dad. I've lost the kid I never had. Now what do I do?
And me? I haven't lost a thing!
Well, what do I do?
Well, what I'm gonna do is go to sleep. The peace will keep.
Yeah, let's all give it a try.
There's a bed in here. Oh, did anyone see... forget it. Exciting, but rest is best for the eyes. I miss my eyes, believe it or not. I have a wild desire to see the dawn. Tomorrow, describe the sky to me. Just make a little speech. If you do, you know what I'll do? I'll give you a cigarette. Each. Good night. Good night. Oh, good night.